Race relations between African Americans and whites in Dane County, Wisconsin, is the topic of a conversation titled Race to Equity, a Progress Report. The Race to Equity Report was commissioned in 2012 by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. The purpose was to explore, measure, and analyze the extent and pattern of racial disparities between African Americans and whites living in Dane County. The goal is to create a foundation to advance collective action towards solutions. We brought four panelists together to discuss this issue. Ken Taylor is the Executive Director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Sharon Corrigan is the Chair of the Dane County Board of Supervisors. Percy Brown is the Director of Equity and Student Achievement for the Middleton School District. And Deshaun McKinney is President of the UW-Wisconsin Union and an activist in Black Lives Matter. The talk took place on February 8, 2017, at the South Madison Public Library and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County, and The Progressive. The talk was moderated by Molly Plunkett, a board member for the Madison Institute. We also hear from Kaleem Kerr, Executive Director for the One City Early Learning Project, which argues for free preschool education for every child in Wisconsin. First, we hear from Ken Taylor, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
When we started to sort of understand the racial equity challenges in our sort of home community where we're located, we decided that we needed to take a deeper look at that. And we weren't really sure where it was going to lead because it wasn't. We hadn't been working intensely at the Dane County level. It had been mainly state. And also, when you produce something like this, you don't know if anyone's going to pay attention or not. You hope. You do the best work you can. You try to get it out there. But, you know, we didn't know if anyone was going to pay attention. And it did have some impact, we think, and the conversation has continued and brought me here tonight to speak with you. So the goal was to look at the data and see what we could find out. But the data is not an end in itself. You know, it really is to create change and to engender action. But we believe that we need to have a factual basis for that. And when we started, and we knew that we had wide disparities in our community, we didn't fully understand, and we still are learning what that means and how that has come to be. But when we looked at it, our assumption was that one of the reasons that the disparities were large here was basically because we knew that the white population did better on average than other places. And we were thinking that because of that, that was really the genesis of the disparities. And what we found out was that was true, and was also true that people of color in our community, particularly African Americans, were struggling more and had greater challenges and had many additional barriers and don't do as well here on average as other places. And that leads to the larger disparities that we see here in Dane County. And that was news to us. So we spent a year with the data before we actually produced this report trying to learn and communicate, and we talked to forums like this to anyone who would be willing to talk to us. You know, and I would say that fairly universally, when we were in predominantly white audiences, this would be new information to many. But when we were, you know, speaking with African American audience, they're saying, you know, you're not telling me anything I don't know that I haven't experienced. And so we had to say, well, and we understand that what we need to do is understand the narrative better so that we can do what we do to present that narrative and have it be an accurate depiction of your experience for the broader community to better understand. Because we still find this is 4 years later, that we're presenting to audiences that this is new information to them, that are predominantly white. And like I said, universally, we've heard from communities of color, you're not telling, there's no new information in this document. So one of the things that we've learned is that we really need to be clear about what some of the challenges are, and one of the risks that we were facing, that we still run with information like this, is that it might reinforce negative stereotypes that people already have. I don't have a better answer other than to say that we know that that's a risk, but that we have to raise these issues in order to confront them, and that that's not our purpose, but this could be misused in that way, and we have to be really active in our efforts to make sure that that is not the case. And the other thing that I always try to say is, you know, this is not a zero-sum game, and so oftentimes people try to pit one group against another, and so we really have to think about this as all of us and how we are collectively together, and it's not a zero-sum effort in order to move beyond this. The other thing that I just, before I get into the data itself, that I want to mention is people often come up after I've presented saying, well, what can I do as a result of this, or what I've learned, or what you've activated. And so oftentimes these are people that I don't know. In fact, they're pretty much always people that I don't know. And so I have to say, well, I don't know you. I don't know what your passion is, what your gifts are, but there are some categories for you to think about. So I'm just going to preempt that question in all of you. And so the way I think about it is that we all have work that we could do. Well, there's not that we all do. I would argue that there's something in these categories for everyone. So one of them is around sort of the personal work. So I think I would argue that we all have personal work that we need to do around racial equity and implicit bias and all sorts of things. And so we have internal work, and we also have what I think of as external personal work. It's about relationship building. It's about engagement. It's about being connected. The second one is around organizations. So we're all part of different kinds of organizations. And so what is it that your organization does, and how can you be a force for equity within that organization, whether you have a formal role, an informal role, whether you have a leadership role or not? And then third, there's things at the systems level. So much of this is driven by systems that either purposefully or through neglect continue to drive these inequities. And so what is it that you can do, that each of us can do at the systems level to change these? And we're gonna hear from systems folks in here a few minutes. So again, thinking about what can I do personally in my life, what can I do organizationally, and what can I do at the systems level? Because it really is about taking the next step, and it's about action. As was said, a lot of data, 46 different data indicators, we're in the process of updating them. And I'll just share a little bit about the basic demographics and then economic well-being and education. So rough figures, we are a county of about 500,000 people. About 6.5% African-American. The child population, African-American children, about 9,000 kids. About 20% of the Madison School District are African-American kids. And the communities of color are the growing parts of our community. So for example, from 2000 to 2010, the African-American community grew by 50% in our county, from 20 to 30,000, roughly. And the Latino population is growing faster, and subsequent to the publishing of our initial report, the Latino population is now larger than the African-American population in our county. So that's the report that we did look just at disparities between African-American community and the white community. We're looking at other different racial and ethnic groups. And we did that for a couple reasons. One was because we knew that there was a lot of work and a heavy lift to understand that that set of disparities. And we also know that the story is different. And we didn't think that we could do justice to the challenges of the African-American white disparity picture if we also were looking the challenges in the Latino population, in the Native American population, in the Asian American population. And so this is where we started, and that's where the predominance of our effort has been. But we are working to expand the work of the project. But we also have real cultural competency and other competency issues that we need to develop in order to do that work well, and we're just not there yet. Okay, so just real quickly, I tell what I think of as the tale of two cities. So City A, the first city, is white Dane County. City B, African-American Dane County. So unemployment, City A, 5%. City B, 21%. Job poverty rate, City A, 5.6%. City B, 57%. Median household income, City A, 87,000. City B, 27,000. Third grade reading proficiency, City A, only 50%. That means third graders reading at the third grade level in third grade. 50%, that's not a good number. City B, 15%. Not graduating on time, City A, 11%. This is one of the numbers that we're best at as a state and a nation, high school graduation. Yet nearly 50% of our African-American kids don't graduate high school on time. So those are the numbers. And the challenges that we have aren't just between African-American population. Just real quickly, child poverty, I said, the 57% for the African-American population. It's about 31% for Latinos, 30% for Native Americans, and 20% for Asian kids. So still sort of four times, five times, six times, and then 10 times higher for kids of color than for white kids. And we just put out a report ourselves at the state level around the impacts of poverty on kids, and we know the long-term negative impacts are significant in all sorts of ways. And so that's something that we absolutely have to get ahead of. So what are we doing? Well, one of the principles for us is around really engaging with families and communities. As a policy organization, this is something that we're growing into. We're not where we need to be on that, but we're really working hard to engage with children and families in a different way, to really learn what the challenges are that folks are facing, and how we can then connect to the systems level, which is really where we do most of our work. But it has to be informed through real relationships with people who are experiencing challenge. We believe that there's a two-generation approach that is essential, that oftentimes at the policy level, people talk about focusing on kids. Well, guess what? Kids grow up in families. You can't support kids without supporting families. And oftentimes, policymakers, if they do care about kids, oftentimes they separate kids from families and what they're trying to do. And so we need to get around that. And we have to have both a sense of urgency and a long-term commitment. I mean, we have serious challenges, political and otherwise. We didn't get here overnight, and so we're not going to get out of it overnight. But we do have to have a sense of urgency as we're addressing this. So one of our colleagues at the Center on Wisconsin Strategies, or they don't call themselves that anymore, they're just CALS, they just released a report, and one of the things that they said, it wasn't always this way. So when you look at the huge disparities that we have today, and you compare it back to where we were in the 70s, we were not an outlier. I'm not saying that things were great, right? But we are an outlier as a community and as a state when it comes to these gaps, and that wasn't always the case. So oftentimes people say, well, this is so systemic, this is so deep, what can I do, throw up my hands? Well, there are things that we can do. We're going to be hearing from folks who are doing things. And so oftentimes I really depress people when I present. This isn't good news, right? So I think there's a certain amount of, we should be depressed by this, but it shouldn't depress us to the point of inaction. We can change these dynamics. It hasn't always been this way. And we make choices in all sorts of aspects of our life. So we can start to make different choices. And you being here today is an important part of that. And so I look forward to hearing from the rest of the panelists. I would say, so we have a website that has more information about this for people who are looking for more information. We've tried to document all the things that are happening in the community. This was just a first step because we realized that we didn't know all the things that were going on. And so we documented about 150 different things. We're trying to keep it updated. And then ultimately, we are trying to develop a plan of action. We call it the roadmap. And there's a bunch of different folks that are working on that and helping us understand it. And so we're looking for feedback on that as well. But we're working with organizations and systems who are engaged in that, the county, the schools, United Ways, and others, to say, well, what do we do now, and what do we do differently, and how do we come together on this? And this roadmap is not a perfect plan. It was just a starting point for an ongoing conversation that tried to say, well, these are the things that we think we should be working on. What do you think? What's wrong? What's right? And how do we move on from here? So thank you.
Now we hear from Sharon Corrigan, Chair of the Dane County Board of Supervisors.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you for your work on this report. It's been so important. As you said, it wasn't the first report that looked at the state of Black Madison. I mean, there was a report called that, but this was a report that really came at a time that I think that there was a real openness in the community to hear the message that you were saying, and I also think the picture that you painted was one that we couldn't ignore, and it helped spur a lot of action on this. So thank you for your work and for the organization's work. Before I get started, I want to point out an audience member who's been so involved in the county board's effort to move forward on racial equity and social justice, and that's Supervisor Sheila Stubbs, who we're in her district right now, but she's so that's one reason she's here. But she's also here because this has been an area that she's led so much in, and I feel like I'm talking about a lot of the things that she spearheaded as we talk about what the county's done in terms of racial equity. And so thank you for coming tonight, Sheila. On the board over here, we talked about the basic demographics and economic well-being and education being some of the things that we're really going to focus on tonight, but I am also going to focus on the criminal justice system. And I really, it's not only because it's an area that we've really worked hard on and have a lot of exciting accomplishments in at the county level, but I feel like it really drives the well-being, the economic well-being of a community in a negative way, when there's a disproportionate incarceration of people of color in this county. And that's something that we're experiencing in Dane County, and it's something we've worked very hard to try to change the pattern on. But that affects the education and the health and the economic status of a community. So it's really an important component of what the county has done. And we started our work in the county, Sheila started leading the work in the county on criminal justice reform back in 2008 when there was a Dane County task force on racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And it was a group that worked for a year and issued a report with many, many recommendations in it about ways to reduce the racial disparities in the system in Dane County. And it involved people from through all aspects of the criminal justice system and the community coming together to make those recommendations. And, you know, it was everything from providing additional funding for diversion, increasing funding to community-based organizations to help with reentry into the community from the criminal justice system, and to prevent entry into the criminal justice system, and to funding, you know, simple things like funding a driver's license recovery program so that people could work, you know, if they lost their driver's license, and hiring a grant writer at the county level. So those were some of the many things that were in there. Some of those had been accomplished before your report came out, but some of those, that report really helped us spur some action on doing some of the pieces in the report that hadn't yet been accomplished. And things like hiring a criminal justice grant writer. We in the county board hired a criminal justice and equity coordinator who works for the county board, Colleen Clark Bernhardt, and she's done many aspects of the work on criminal justice, but she's also a grant writer, and she's enabled us to really get some amazing accomplishments at the county level. And one of those, she staffs the Criminal Justice Council, first of all, and the Criminal Justice Council is an important part of attacking the problem of disparities in the system, because there isn't just a switch that we can switch and say, okay, we're going to do things differently. We all decide, we decided that. And, you know, the system involves the district attorney, the presiding, the judges that are making decisions, and the funding that the county board and the county exec provide for things. It involves the clerk of the courts who works on the diversion programs and the pretrial and also the post-trial aspects of it. So that the Criminal Justice Council brings together the sheriff and the district attorney and the presiding judge and the county board chair and the county exec and the clerk of courts to sit on one committee and really to focus on what kind of changes we're going to make in this system. And so it's really an important effort to keep people together and bring people forward.
You're listening to a panel discussion on Race to Equity, a progress report.
So one of the changes that we made is we created the Community Restorative Court in Dane County. There are some examples that are similar to what we're doing here, but it's unique to Dane County, and we've piloted it in the area that we're sitting in right now. And this court is aimed at 17 to 25-year-olds to try to keep them out of the criminal justice system, because once you get arrested and go into the system, it's forever on your record through CCAP. And so we wanted to figure out a way to keep people out of the system. They've committed an offense, and they right now it's for misdemeanor charges. If you're 17 to 25 years old, that you have the opportunity to go through the community restorative court, and that is to work with a group of peacemakers who are volunteers that are trained in the community to work with victims and perpetrators of an offense, and to try to bring them together to have someone who's done something take responsibility for it, to recognize the offense and the harm that they've created to an individual or to a community, and to try to understand that in a way that keeps them from reoffending. And if they agree to go through this system, they don't have the charge on their record, and they're able, and it's been really successful for so many, over, I think it's 97% of the cases that we've had so far, the individuals have completed the, going through the program, and we still, we're still early in it to test the long term of not going back, but other communities that have done similar programs have seen a lot of success to stop that cycle of returning into the criminal justice system. Our grant writer at the county level has enabled us to get funding to help support bringing that system countywide. The criminal justice, the community restorative court, as I said, was piloted here. We're now taking it countywide, and we just got a grant from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation to help us with technical assistance and actual dollars to help us bring that community restorative court countywide. And it's particularly exciting because the MacArthur Foundation has really targeted criminal justice reform as an area in reducing disproportionate incarceration of minorities as an area that they want to attack. And to be part of their cadre now, we've gotten, I mean, the money, I think there is a chance to get more funds too, to be able to move this forward. So we're excited about that. We also have, our grant writer also enabled us to work on a project on a pretrial assessment, and that is the decision of in the court system when you get arrested, the decision whether to keep you in jail or to release you, and to release you requiring just a signature or if you have to make bond, pay bond. So it's a decision that there is a disparity in who and how the choice that is made. And in Dane County, we haven't had an assessment or data to help make that assessment. And we have a grant from the Laura and John Arnold Foundation to be able to put in place a pretrial assessment that the court commissioner will receive. That is a basic kind of summary of their what an individual's background is, and be able to, with data, help make an educated guess of whether someone should be kept in jail or whether they should be released until trial. And so we're testing this out. We don't know, you know, what the impact is going to be, and Harvard University is partnering with us also to test this out and to study it. So we're excited about that, and we hope to make some real change in keeping people out of jail and in having more people kept out of jail before trial, especially, and have it be racially balanced when we do that. And that's the goal of that. So also, we have looked at county operations and as a whole, and trying to figure out how we can better economically help the minority communities, how we can make sure that we're hiring in a way, how we promote people at the county. And we first started by, we passed a resolution at the county board in 2014 that was called the Dane County Equity Initiative, and it was seeking to have equity in county infrastructure, in county operations, in county budgets, policies and programs, and equity in our community. And those are all nice words of like, well, we want to do that. And as Ken has said, it's sometimes feels daunting to be able to figure out how to actually put into action what you would like to have happen. And so what we did was we did a racial equity assessment of the whole county. We paid a consultant who's an expert to come in and to give us a work plan for changes to make at the county level in, you know, throughout the county government to develop infrastructure and tools to increase Dane County's employees and residents' understanding of and the ability to advance racial equity. So to institutionalize the thinking at the county level about that you need to be thinking about this every day in your work, and to implement strategies to ensure that Dane County is effective and inclusive and that we engage our community and we respond to the needs of the community, so that as people provide services at the county level, they're thinking of this. And to really to drill down and figure out how to make the changes that we need to make. And one of the first things that was done was the county created an Office of Equity and Inclusion as a department at the county, because there was a recognition that if we're going to do this, this is something that we have to highlight. We have to have a department head who's working with all the other department heads and helping to lead the work. There are teams that meet regularly that are cross-department, that each department has a plan to address equity issues, not only at the level of, you know, staffing and trying to figure out how we have more staff of color, but also the actual services that are provided, and to have a plan to improve outcomes at the county level. And I should say, on the staffing level, we have now hired a diversity recruitment specialist to work with entities that are training individuals in the community, so that make sure that minorities that are being trained in the community are getting the skills they need for the types of jobs that we would be looking for. So, and that's our diversity recruitment specialist is working on that. And we've also have a study going on now, not only on the hiring side, but on the contracting side. We buy lots of things. We buy everything from paper to, you know, planning services to, you know, we have contracts through the county, and those contracts are contracts that we give, there's not a balance in that. They're heavily white contractors that we contract with. Well, we're looking at how do we open up this pool better? Do we break down contracts into smaller bits so that there are people that are newer in an industry are able to get it? And we're hoping to improve our diversity in our contracting. As far as also on economic well-being, we looked at the county level, the minimum wage, and the county doesn't have authority to just raise the minimum wage countywide, but we do have control over what we pay people and what people that we contract with pay. And we changed, we currently had a living wage that was calculated that was just a little over $11 before we made this change, but we put into place a path to a $15 minimum wage. And the first step was increasing it to $12.50 an hour, and then by 2022, we'll be at $15, which is similar to what was done in California and New York. They have a graduated stepping up to a $15 minimum wage. And really, that's just fundamental, that you can't address a lot of your other needs if you're in poverty. And so while we couldn't control it for everyone, we could control it for one aspect of it. And we're proud that we were able to do that. I think, you know, the other thing is to try to think in all our work at the county how we're going to make the changes that make a huge impact. And one project that we're working on that we really have hope for that it would have an important impact on the community that surrounds us tonight, and that we are very near to the Alliant Energy Center, and we're looking at making changes there, a long-term plan to have that be a stronger economic component in our community, and to revitalize the area around it too, to work with the cities that are surrounding it, so that it's stronger. And I think that's a real opportunity to provide jobs, entry-level jobs, because we're looking at the possibility of having more services, whether they're restaurants or hotels, that are there, and it's close by. And that's just an example of something that I think we need to be thoughtful of as we do projects, that we're providing a positive economic impact on communities that need that. So that's an overview of a lot of different areas that we're working on, and we're proud to be making the progress that we are, but we know we have a long way to go too at the county level and other areas of government too that are working on this. But I hope, while the progress may be incremental, that we're moving forward, and we try to keep our foot on the gas pedal to keep going forward.
You are listening to Race to Equity, a progress report.
I will use my prerogative as moderator to ask one question, Ken. You were looking at the COW statistics, and haven't the unemployment numbers come down a little bit in 5 years? I thought because their year, the original report said 25, and now I think it's down to 19%.
Yeah, so because of the economic recovery, you know, nationally and locally, the employment numbers are getting better across the board. One of the challenges, you know, I'm a data guy, right? So there's always more data to look at. And so one of the challenges with that is, well, what are the, first of all, the unemployment figure is a weirdly constructed figure. Because if you drop out of the labor force, then you're not counted at all. Anyway, so there's that problem. The other problem is it doesn't tell you what the wage, you know, what the job is like, right? So while the figures are getting better, what we're finding is the jobs that are coming back pay a lot less than the jobs that were lost. And we know that people coming into the labor force and the particularly people of color in our community are more likely to be at the low end of the income bracket. So even if the numbers are getting better, and they are, and that's a good thing, the pay that people are getting, even when they get a job, is much worse than before. So it's a mixed picture there.
Next, we hear from Percy Brown, Director of Equity and Student Achievement for the Middleton School District.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and to my esteemed panelists that I'm with tonight and the moderator. Wow, I'm on the south side of Madison. I was born in Methodist Hospital. For all of you that have been in Madison for over 40 years, I think Methodist closed in the late 70s or something like that. The building's still there. Actually, Park Village, right across the street, is where my mom and dad lived when I came into the world. Played for the Southside Raiders at Penn Park. My home church, Mount Zion, is literally a few blocks from here. So this is my old stomping grounds. And I've heard a lot of information. I've worked with Ken, actually, with the Race and Equity Report on some presentations. I'm aware of what's going on in Dane County in terms of criminal justice reform. But, you know, living the experience, I don't need to read the Race to Equity report. You know, I grew up with so many friends on the South Side, and I've got my brother Kaleem back there, who's a few years older than me, and we literally lived about two blocks away from each other, and he can probably attest to the same thing that I saw growing up. So, you know, it's real, and it's been real. But I also want to thank Kaleem for opening my eyes. I always had something burning in me to be a person of service, especially around issues of social justice. I do come from a background where my dad's side of the family were heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the Mississippi Delta. So it was coded in my DNA, but when I came back from college in 98, I did my undergraduate studies in Mississippi. Kaleem had like this 250-page report when he was working for DPI, like basically breaking down all of the racial disparities in education historically in the Madison area. And I was a history major, so I was just all in. And I'm like, man, this brother put this together. I'm like, wow. So, you know, I was inspired, and that is really what, you know, allowed me to plant myself here as a native of Madison and to try to play my part in tackling the challenges that we face. But I think one thing that hasn't been mentioned, I think this community has not been dealing in reality for a long time, but I think that not only speaks to this community, but nationally, when we really sit down and think about race and the disparities that we see across the country. You know, for me, being a history guy, it's always about root cause and analysis. And if you really just think about race and not look at it from the perspective of biology, but look at it from the framework of how this country was developed and what it represented. Race was more about a socioeconomic caste system. You know, of course, there was over 200 years of slavery, but then that was followed by 100 years of Jim Crow. And, you know, you can possibly argue that during the period of Jim Crow, it may have actually been better for blacks than it is during this period of integration over the 50, the last 50 or 60 years, when you consider the fact that because we weren't able to shop and spend money with white businesses, we had to develop our own economic floor. So we had our own doctors and lawyers and schools. But then when we integrated, you know, we pushed the dollar into the national economy, but I don't think that the systems were ready to include us. We definitely could sit down at lunch counters and vote in 65, but I think as far as economic opportunities, I think that flatlined. And the other reason why I say that, you know, we're really not dealing in reality is because I'm gonna go back and talk about MLK for a little bit. You know, every third Monday, I believe it is, man, Madison has like this huge deal. I mean, actually the whole weekend, right? You've got the big service at the Rotunda at noon, and then you've got the big celebration at the Overture Center at 6 o'clock. And we always use King the Dreamer. That's what we always talk about, King. We may refer to the Montgomery bus boycott of 54 or Selma, which helped, you know, pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But we don't talk too much about King in his last 2 years. He, you know, I saw an interview with King in 1967, and he talked about how his dream had in so many ways became a nightmare. When he saw what was going on in Vietnam, you know, just the hardcore pushback to the civil rights movement. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover had COINTELPRO monitoring all of the civil rights activists. So it wasn't like, you know, the country was all on board. There was a lot of resistance. And he also had, you know, confided in Harry Belafonte in his last 2 years of his life and said that, you know, to walk black people into integration is like walking black people into a burning house. But that's the King that we don't talk about. And I think that's the reality that we have to face. We definitely need to change systems, but I think this issue of race is a war for the individual soul. And because of dog whistle politics, which really started in the 70s with the Nixon campaign, you know, that really just changed how we talked about race. They call it the Southern Strategy, right? So it's, we can't be overt in our racism and call black people niggers anymore. We have to become more abstract in how we talk and how we pass policies in a way where they become colorblind but negatively impact people of color. And the systems here in Madison are running like that, but it's because we're not looking at it from the right perspective, and we're not looking at it in reality. We do have issues of racism in this community. I mean, look at what happened at the Badger football game. I can't tell you how many situations I've dealt with this year in the Middleton School District with white students making crazy racist comments, and you probably saw about the one that actually went viral a couple of weeks ago. And it's ramping up, I think, a lot because of the national mood, right? Tony Robinson, Janelle Laird, you know, and these are both situations where the victim was blamed for their outcome. And where was the pushback from the community to say, we really need to question this, because did it really have to go down like that? I mean, Janelle Laird, you know, you saw it on video, gets beat, gets tased. But then in order, she gets charged. And then in order to have the charges dropped, she had to apologize and write a letter to the police officers who inflicted pain on her. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And then for Chief Cobalt, and I don't really know him like that, to sit up there and say, well, she should have surrendered her liberties. See, I'm a historian, I read through things. And that sounded like a slave master to me. So I was upset. And now I'm about to spend in the education, you know, Kaleem pushing Madison Prep to create an alternative option. I'm pro-education, but when we look at the statistical outcomes for black and brown students, and you can go way back to when I was in school in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, something's not working. So why not think outside of the box and create alternative options? So Kaleem comes with something, and they take him through the hoops. Oh, it just can't be for black boys. And then, okay, well, we do black boys, Latino boys. Oh, no, you just can't do males. You can't be gender specific. No, you know, now he makes a co-ed. And then it's instrumentality versus non-instrumentality. And I'm like, wow, they are really taking this brother through the ringer. So the board votes it down. And I'm working in central office at the time. And somebody said that there was an achievement gap plan. And that's why the board didn't want to support it. But there was no plan. You know, I could care less now because I don't work for the district. But then I think last week I see Madison School District approves a Montessori charter, but to delay it by a year. And I'm sitting here like, wow, Kaleem tries to bring something to address what's happening in our schools across Dane County and the state of Wisconsin, but it gets shut down. But Montessori can come with a K-8 charter, and there were some questions, but they approved it with a one-year delay. So what's the real issue? Do we not want to create an alternative option which could show that black kids are capable of, you know, performing much better than below proficiency levels? Do they feel like they will be like, oh my God, we've been exposed? Or do they look at that as an opportunity to create something outside of the box? And if it works, then we figure out how do we bring that into our public schools? But we don't want to have that conversation. And, you know, this is what it really boils down to. And King said it back in the 60s, and we really need to own this and talk about it. We got affirmative action. We got voting rights. We were able to go into white restaurants and sit on the front of the bus, but all that took was a stroke of the pen. Where was the economic injection to the black community for the 200 plus years of slavery and the 100 years plus of Jim Crow? And not to mention what happened in the 70s and 80s with the heroin epidemic and then the crack cocaine epidemic. And we know where the cocaine was coming from. It was tied to the Iran-Contra scandal. When the CIA were running guns into Latin America in exchange for cocaine, and where were they dropping the cocaine off? But we're not talking about it in reality. But it does begin with a war for your soul. And for me, I lead this work from a place of compassion. And compassion will move you to work with people and to want to help people without judging them for how they show up. You won't blame them for how they show up. I don't care if you're a prostitute, a drug dealer, a drug user. I have to meet you in a place of coming compassionate so that maybe we can connect so that we can help each other. But that's gonna take all of us being in the same place if we really want to confront this. And I've seen some of that in Middleton.
You're listening to a panel discussion on Race to Equity, a Progress Report.
Now I'm going to talk about some of the good stuff, right? I charged you up a little bit and hit you with a challenge. The leaders that I work with in Middleton, and it's been just a short run, we began this journey together working from the inside out. So it started with self-reflection on who are we? What are our beliefs and value systems? And what does this racial achievement gap mean to me? How am I impacting it positively? How am I impacting it negatively? And instead of blaming the data or the outcomes on black kids or the families, we started to look not only at ourselves, but then to look at the systems as flawed. And what do we need to do to change the systems? So we've really opened up opportunities for staff by creating, I would say, pretty strong professional development that goes deep into implicit bias, systems of advantage, systems of disadvantage, oppression, you know, all of the good stuff that that was in the introduction. But we've also changed our systems. We've done a phenomenal job of diversifying in the last couple of years. I think my first 2 years, I was the only certified black staff in the district. But now I've got Rainey Briggs, who is a district level leader. I've got Jalatipa Joe Myers, who's a district level leader. They're both African American. We have a Latino assistant principal at the high school. We've diversified our staff in the transportation department and our teaching aid position. So when we became intentional and we started to own the flaws in the system, it made it a lot easier for us to start making those types of changes, right? We've even reallocated some resources to create positions to do specific and targeted work for our African-American population. And I've got one brother in here, Matthew Brongen, who was hired into one of those new positions, and I'm just so glad to have him. And he's a soldier, but, you know, when you do good things like diversify your staff and you get more people in your schools, now you got more eyes and you start peeling back the layers and you're like, man, this is deeper than I thought it was. It's really, really deep. I mean, not just the biases that teachers have, but I'm talking about the bias in the curriculum. And when teachers have to interact with the curriculum to be culturally responsive, but if they have these biases, it makes it very difficult for them to engage it, embed it, and teach it. Matt can probably speak to that because, you know, that's why he's there, and he's experienced some pushback or some levels of resistance. And this is Black History Month. You know, and he's trying to do that for Black. I mean, I hate to put the district out there like that, but as we do great things, we uncover more issues. So I guess it's kind of like a gift and a curse, right? We've created a lot of great opportunities for kids. This year will be the fifth year of the spring break trip that we do for kids. That's always a multicultural group of students. We started by going to Atlanta. We visited historically Black colleges. We did the King Center. We toured CNN. And then we ended up going to Washington, D.C., met with Senator Ron Johnson, believe it or not. but we also met with a congresswoman out of Chicago who was a Democrat, so they had an opportunity to, you know, meet somebody from Congress on both sides, the House, the Senate, Democrat, and Republican. Did all of National Mall, did some cool tours, Frederick Douglass's house, Mount Vernon. It just really eye-opening for the kids. Then we reenacted the Freedom Rides of 1964. So we went into Memphis, went to the National Civil Rights Museum, rode into the Mississippi Delta, visited historically Black colleges, went to Megar Evers' home, and went to New Orleans. And last year we went to New York. I mean, I had like 45 kids, Black, white, Latino, and Asian, in Harlem, in the projects, going through like a civil rights tour right off of Lenox Boulevard and Malcolm X. Like, it changed their lives. But it also brought those kids together in an authentic way. So even though it's small and you're only taking like between 40 and 50 kids on those trips, it brings them together in a powerful way. They become social justice focused, and we've got students doing amazing things, not only interacting with their peers, but they're doing professional development for teachers. We've got them sitting down working with district leaders because, you know, we don't have all the answers as adults, right? We have to empower the student voice and hear about what they think needs to happen. And that really helps the change process. But as far as the Race to Equity report with the recommendations, and then I'll close because I know I got to let this young brother talk because I'm just impressed with this young man right here, and then we'll have some time for questions. But the two-generation approach, the roadmap, the work is really rolling in Middleton, and we've got the entire community engaged. Because of students working on social justice issues and doing a panel discussion on race it got Chief Folk, who's the chief of police for Middleton, fired up. And he ended up doing like the UW Big Read Just Mercy with the entire police department and the Common Council. And then there ended up being a panel discussion at the library that was at capacity. And then he was like, wow, we got to keep going, Percy. So then I worked with Laura Love, who's in the district, and we packaged one of our PD opportunities for staff, but tweaked it for the community to really get into issues of race and bring in historical context. So we did that for the community and had over 100 participants. But then we said we can't stop there, right? So we're going to continue to have ongoing learning opportunities, but we started inviting people from the community together to say, not only do we want to learn, but now let's act together in a really collaborative way. So we've created the Middleton Equity Team, and that consists of people from the Common Council. We've got the Dane County Board represented. We've got district leaders. We've got several clergy. We've got the Middleton Chamber of Commerce. We've got the United Way. We've got Andre Johnson from Dane County Human Services. Sarah Schatz from Joining Forces for Family, and then all of the a lot of community-based organizations in Middleton. And we're really sitting down and saying, you know, how can we really address these systemic issues in a collaborative way and stop working in silos? And what I mean by stop working in silos by saying, you know, let's bring our human capital together. Let's bring our financial capital together. And the framework that we're using are the three goals within this two-generational approach, and we are thinking long-term and not a two- or three-year deal, but really trying to embrace this two-generational approach. But we're really forming these groups. We've got them broken down into the three subcommittees based on the goals, and I think we've got about 40 people right now, but it's in the infancy stages, but we're really using that team to attack the gaps in the district, but also work with the impoverished families of the kids of the district to find out what is it that we can do as a community to help with employment opportunities, to help with child care opportunities, to help with health care opportunities, so that we really are taking this wraparound approach, not only as a school district, but as an entire community. But we've got a lot of work to do, but I'm also concerned about Madison, Dane County, and the state of Wisconsin. But I think, again, you know, we really have to look inward. We have to confront the reality of racism in Madison, but we got to look at it from a historical lens, right? Because I think that will help us work through that. But then we also have to understand that there's going to have to be some level of an economic boost and injection specifically and targeted to poor communities of color if we really want to see some of the gaps start to change, because we have to change the systems, but the systems still aren't that inviting yet. And I'm just going to give you one quick story, and then I promise I'll pass it. I got my start in education working in the Madison School District. And Bruce Diamond hired me at Memorial, and man, he was like a dad to me. He immediately took me under his wings and mentored me and was grooming me for leadership. So I worked there for 5 years, and then I ended up zigzagging around. I had an interim assistant principal position at East, and then I went in the central office. But there were 2 years in a row where I was looking for opportunities for leadership, and it didn't happen. But the people who were hired, they got me. But, you know, like the superintendent pulled me in and said, you know what, your time is coming. We really love you. Boom, that opportunity came. Shut out. Thank God for Middleton, because that was really my first opportunity to see and demonstrate what kind of a leader I could become, because they embraced me, they supported me. But even when I was in Middleton, I was recruited by the Madison School District 4 years in a row, and I came through the district, right? They do not have one African-American male of leadership that has gone through that district. So here I am in a great situation in Middleton, but was still willing to say, you know what, I will come back because I have an obligation to my district, right? But it didn't happen, and I ended up talking to a black pastor about it, and he told me, he said, you know, Percy, Madison School District was never going to put you in a position of leadership. And I said, why? And he was like, because they knew they wouldn't be able to control you. And I was like, wow. But they should have never really looked at it like that, because I'm a servant leader. I am there to serve kids and wanting to do what's best for kids. But maybe they just didn't want the challenge of difficult conversations. So here I am, you know, I would say polished. I'm about to be a doctor. I've got credentials, right? Yet I still face barriers. So if I'm facing barriers with all of those credentials, and thank God for Middleton again, because they really opened up the door for me, what happens to the black man who has a misdemeanor charge or made a mistake when he was 18, but then has been trying to do it right ever since? It's gonna be hard as hell, because it was hard as hell for me to try to get back into Madison. But you know, I just threw the towel in. I said, you know what? God said, boy, I don't want you back in there. I got you in Middleton for a reason. So I'm in Middleton. Thank you, Ellen Lindgren. So I'm gonna shut up right now and then pass the mic over here to my brother.
You're listening to a panel discussion on Race to Equity, a Progress Report. And now we hear from Deshaun McKinney, president of the UW-Wisconsin Union and an activist in Black Lives Matter.
I think I've been turning over a lot of what's been discussed on the panel already over my head and trying to figure out where exactly I want to take things. And something that Percy said made me want to preface my portion. The whole idea of Madison kind of not addressing things in a realistic manner, right? Not necessarily living in reality. I think that there's a certain aspect to that in general in terms of what the North looks like in the country, right? If we're being honest, it's very easy for the North to be like, it doesn't happen here. That's a their thing, right? It's to feel removed from it because it's explicit elsewhere, right? And it's very easy for people to not address it when it's not explicit. And I think part of what I've noticed in my time here in Madison during my college career and even people program prior to that, like for Madison, what it was that the blinder was being slapped with the label of being a liberal city. And that's a lot of what it was. That allowed people to, for so long, to just say that that's not a here thing, that's a there thing. And that's part of what spurred these disparities and part of what allows them to not only manifest, but then duplicate and just exponentially increase, which is what they've done, right? They've ballooned out of, to a point that's just out of control, that doesn't even register logically, right? So along those lines, I mean, it doesn't even make sense further, right? You can't say that that's a their thing. What it looks like here is the furniture at the university being made from prison labor, right? With a contract with Badger State Industries. So right, that's what the problem looks like in the North. But it's very easy for people to ignore those kind of things. So I appreciate that point about people not living in reality necessarily. And the reason that I wanted to hinge on that point is because I also want to say that another thing that people do is they take in a lot of information and it makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they've done something, that's the change. And so as we sit up here on this panel, I also want people to know that this isn't it, right? Nothing that we've said tonight is enough for you all. Like, I don't want people to walk away from here and I get it, this is a part of it, right? Knowledge acquisition is important, but it's still not enough. And I challenge everybody in the space to always check themselves and let themselves know that it's not enough, right? Even things like you marching in the streets is not enough. I mean, regardless of how you feel about it, that's a piece of the change. It's not the change. And the things that we're saying on this panel are also not that. And it's not enough for us either. And I'm hoping that the people on this panel continue to do the work after we leave here tonight, right? I challenge folks to take the information tonight and to continue to gain knowledge, right? You mentioned the book Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. I encourage folks to read books like that to learn more about the criminal justice system and how it's fundamentally broken, right? It only operates as it is because people don't understand it. Now, if there isn't a real justice system in the country as it operates, right? Like what we have right now is people, it only can continue because people are taking plea deals because they don't understand and for the fear of getting more time. And the fear of going to trial. People don't go to trial. Like 95% of people take plea deals. That's why the system works. That's why the system operates. It would fundamentally break down if we sent those people to trial. right? If people were actually, if we had public defenders who were paid properly and who didn't have caseloads by the hundreds where they can actually talk to the people for more than 5 minutes before they have to make a decision, right? So educate yourselves about that. Read books like Evicted by Matthew Desmond to learn how rent, the woes of renting can put people in a pit that just continues to compound upon itself, right? Read books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. Read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. Watch the documentary 13th. Like, continue with this and also pass those things along. That gets, I think, a point that Ken was making in terms of the relationship building, the external relationship building. Part of that is passing on these resources as well to expand your mind and open it up. I saw a lot of people in the space, as Ken was rattling off the statistics, be shocked. Right? So pass those things along, because I guarantee you there are people in your lives who will have that same reaction. They need this information. And that's also a part of the fight. So I kind of wanted to preface my point with just that, to make sure that there's more that you are doing. Take this information and dig deeper into it once you leave out of this space. Pass it along. Engage in those difficult discussions. And then get those people to do the same thing and make that a cycle. So then they can move on to the next level of things that people can do, which is something that I'll talk more about. But to get into things now, like it was said in the introduction, I'm not from Madison. I grew up on the north side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm a proud native of Milwaukee. But Milwaukee has some harsh realities, just as Dane County does, right? Milwaukee is, like, I'm from the north side because I'm black. And I say that intentionally because Milwaukee is the most segregated city in the country, right? So people that look like me predominantly, by and large, live on the north side of Milwaukee, right? And when people talk about Milwaukee, when people talk about things that they like about Milwaukee, or if a legislator talks about Milwaukee, they're not talking about the north side. That's the black hole of where people don't discuss these. We're the forgotten group, the forgotten people, and as we deal with these issues, right? So I think part of the reason why I'm qualified to even be on this panel is because I also grew up in all of this, all the stuff that we're talking about in the Race to Equity Report. Like, I grew up in it. I grew up in an impoverished state. Like, I come from a family in deep poverty. I grew up around the violence and the drugs, and I understand what it's like to live in a police state. I understand what it's like to have a failing education system, and that's what Milwaukee Public Schools is, and that's what it exists. When I think about my education prior to high school, I don't think about learning things because I can't remember learning things. What I do remember is I would wonder why parents sent their kids back to the same school every year. And I didn't understand it because we weren't learning. And I was one of those kids. So I wonder why every year, why was I back in the same school? Is there nothing else? Is there nothing better? Is nobody working on this? What are these questions? What I remember is I remember the fights. I remember bullets on the school bus. These are the things that I remember, right, from my school. And I remember seventh grade year, we never had a teacher. We only had substitutes, right? And this is not a unique story in Milwaukee Public Schools. And it's not something that's, when you look at the statistics in Dane County, a lot of these same things are happening, particularly in the Madison School District. When you talk about what black kids experience and how they're treated and how they operate through this system, it's not working for them. It's broken for them. Regardless of how it works for other folks, it's not working for those, 20% of black kids or black folks who live in Dane County. I think for me, I had a unique experience. The high school I went to was Rufus King International School, which is by and large an anomaly, a far outlier in Milwaukee public school systems for the most part. There are a couple other schools who are staying close to that, like Ronald Reagan, ironically enough. And that school, when I was attending that school during my tenure, that was the number one public high school in the state, right? But when you look at the juxtaposition of that and the city that it's in, even the neighborhood it was in, I remember every day, if you look across the street from Rufus King High School, what you saw were dilapidated buildings. You saw there were houses with boarded up windows across the street. I remember football players getting robbed after practice. You know, I remember hearing gunshots after football practice. And that's the neighborhood Rufus King existed in. So it's not only is it an outlier, but it's every day fighting against the odds because of it being abandoned and the city being abandoned, this north side being abandoned. So I think that's very much my educational experience. And the ways in which I relate to this. And that's what I go back to when I go back home, right? Like, Milwaukee isn't different because I've made it to this point, right? You know, like, Madison isn't different because Percy made it to this point, right? You know what I mean? These things still exist here. When we go back home to our families and to the people and the places we love, they don't look all that different, right? I'm 22 now. Milwaukee doesn't look very different from how I grew up. And the things that I still experience and the things that I can see in my neighborhood. And now when I come into Madison, I recognize a lot of those similarities and a lot of those same things that are happening. And even on a larger scale and on a worse scale, and that is so ramped up here, which gets back to that point of people having those blinders on and allowing it to perpetuate. So I think from there, something that's important to discuss is also what it looks like, or how the race to equity report and the vast disparities, the disproportionate suspension rates, the disproportionate child poverty level, the unemployment rates, the foster care, all these things, what do they do in the future, right? What happens next, right? I'm in my last year at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but when you look at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, again, it doesn't look like me. That campus is a campus of 43,000 plus students. 75% of those students are white. The black student population on campus hovers between 2 and 3%. Right, we very rarely. It has to be like a really good year. Like the sun has to be just right, shining outside, for us to like hit 1,000 or to go above 1,000 students out of 43,000. And faculty are about the same. There's a 360 to 400 out of the 15,000 or so that exist on campus, right? And so that's what the demographics of that university look like. And it's part and parcel because of what's happening in Dane County. The county isn't preparing black students to be able to succeed at this level. And they're also not pulling people in. You also, Percy mentioned the noose incident earlier from Camp Randall. And I remember I responded to that incident. I know the chancellor quite well and all the work that I've done. And we also had a meeting with black alum from the university to come in and speak with the chancellor. And part of what they talked about is that there's no connection between black alum and the university and like the alumni association. That work isn't put in. So when you think about like how these things, like in a sense, it's like a very negative trickle up effect, right? That happens as a result of everything that's happened in Dane County. The people can't get in that look like me. People aren't reached out to that look like me because they're fundamentally forgotten. They're like lost in the system because we've been allowing this to happen and to perpetuate itself. There aren't proper resources. There aren't people dedicating these. I think better is there aren't people dedicating these resources, right? We talk a lot about that there isn't. Well, if only we can find the funds. The funds exist, right? The funds exist. The people power exists. The intellectual power exists to address these issues. What it takes is to wake yourselves up and shake yourselves out of that foundation and fundamentally shift what the system is. It's very comfortable where it is. It's working how it wants to work, and it's not going to change unless people are more active in challenging it and understanding that my life may have to change for other people's lives to improve, which is a scary thought, and I understand it, but it doesn't make it wrong. Right, like that's still what needs to happen. So that's what this kind of looks like at the university level, and which then further perpetuates the problem because then there aren't ways for black families in Dane County to accrue wealth. You can't build wealth. You can't get a proper job. You can't get your foot in the door when you've already been barred out of this educational system. When you've really never been given a chance to progress through this. When you don't have a proper foundation from which to start. At least what it does is it sets you back. Right, and doesn't allow you to reach those heights at the same speed as your peers, as the majority white population throughout Dane County. So I just wanted to kind of touch on those things and give that kind of overview. What's most important to me is talking about what people can do, right? And I think that that's what I want to talk about for the rest, the remainder of my time here. And again, we issue that challenge of people actually getting out and doing things. The first thing I want to say is please stop making new organizations. It's something that, and the reason I say that is because, well, one, because we're in a new political climate, right? We just had a transition of power. We have a new administration in who's been very active in the couple of weeks that they've been in office, to put it lightly. And there are a lot of people who have been like very harmed by these things. There are also a lot of people who've been like shocked awake, right? Similar to how people react to the Race to Equity report back when it was released and even to this day, right? And what people, they get the feeling once they take in that information that they want to do something. But then they've been so removed from it, they don't know the people who've already been doing something. For right, exactly. So they start to go out, they get the people that they know who've also just been shocked away, and they start to just move something. And they also say that they're starting conversations. You're not. You're not starting a conversation. You're not starting a movement. There are people who've already been doing this, and that only perpetuates the problem, because that people power, those resources, that intellectual ingenuity, even if we're talking about it honestly, the racial privilege all goes elsewhere and doesn't go to those organizations who've been doing the work for so long. The platforms that come along with that privilege, that come along with those folks, that come along with people who have established bases of wealth and networks and connections, that all goes elsewhere because these people have just been shocked awake. So that's the first thing I want to say. Stop doing that. Start to look at the people who are already doing the work, the organizations who are already doing the work on the issues that you care about. And that's where you start. And that's what you tap into. And there are a host of issues you can do that on. I was thinking about this coming in today of what kind of organizations that I want to throw out. And I was even talking to folks in the Madison community that I knew and that I wanted to highlight. I think some of them that I want to highlight, we didn't really touch too much on today, but in terms of the criminal justice system, something that's been big in Madison for years now is people trying to win community control over police. That's something you can invest in. There's groups like Freedom Inc. who are working adamantly in the community. Reach out to them, work with them, give resources to them to work on that issue. Work to understand the issue and not get lost in the language surrounding it or in the words, right? Actually work to understand what this is about and understand what that's like, right? Like get police out of schools. Work on that. Look for organizations that are doing that. Let's start to dismantle the system of mass incarceration that exists. Like the arrest rates here are wildly out of control as well, right? And we've been having conversations about renovating a jail. That's not where that money should be going. When we're talking about the educational disparities that exist here, right? So much money that's not being invested in education is being invested in mass incarceration. That's a huge problem, right? We have a quarter of the world's prison population with about 5% of the world's population. It doesn't make sense. It's an illogical system, and it's not as profitable as they would lead you to believe. There are funding education is a much more profitable route to go. But what it would take is for people, there'll be people who lose their jobs. There'll be people who have to fundamentally change their lifestyles. And those are the people in privileged positions or in privileged connections. And that's why that system maintains itself, right? So challenge those systems. Think about other organizations in the community. Think about working with EXPO, which is ex-prisoners organizing. Work with the people who are most directly affected and who are most informed on the issues, right? You want to work on prison reform, you want to work on juvenile justice. Talk and work with the people who have already been doing that, who've been through the system, who understand how the system directly impacts you, not just the one time, but throughout your life. You know, don't assume that you know more. You don't, unless you've been there, right? So work with those people. Actually step into the community. Work with other white folks in the community. That's another thing. And I say that intentionally because it also looks different than working with these organizations. But it's also important work. Because then there's also conversations of how can I use my platform and my privileges to help elevate others, right? How can you use that to bring others into the space? How can you bring other folks from these organizations into the spaces in which you operate, into the platforms you have to get audiences with the people who are making these decisions? How can you use that and utilize that? I think take it into your workplaces. What does it look like to review policies, practices, and procedures? Part of the roadmap to equity is making sure that you hire more people from diverse backgrounds, hiring more people of color, reviewing those hiring practices, making sure that your recruitment strategies are proactive and actually tapped into those communities, and that it's not just lip service, and that you're not just stopping at the phrases or the buzzwords of diversity, right? I think another big one is make sure that you're getting involved in local politics. That's something that needs to happen. a fundamental takeover. And not just the presidential elections, not just waiting 4 years to see who's going to be the face of the country, but in the way the country's going, that's going to mean less and less. There's a bill that was just introduced to remove the Department of Education.
Right.
So as these things go, like federal power is, what they were looking for is a reversion back to that. The Southern Strategy is a branch off of that is states' rights. And states' power. That's what things are like reverting back to. So you even need to look more into local politics and local elections where the changes and the people who are making changes on things like these disparities, what actually happens. But you have to be active in that. And as you're being active in that, also think about who are the people who have been most directly affected by this who could be leaders in that. And how do you build those people up as leaders, right? And so you're not just putting yourself in a position to speak for these people, but you're putting these people in a position to speak for themselves. Or resourcing them to get there, supporting them to get there, making sure the information gets out through the community so they can get there, so you can actually build that. And I guess the last thing I'll say before we open up the questions is invest in Black business. That's another thing. And that's something that people don't think a lot about is the financial foundation that's lacking across the country, which allows people to perpetuate the blatantly false bootstrap narrative that you can just pull yourself up. And people think, always go back to my parents were immigrants and they did this and that, but they were also allowed to accrue that wealth. They were allowed to get the homes and to build wealth, not just have money, but to build wealth, right? So like also invest in these Black businesses, invest in groups that are trying to build bases of Black financial power within the Dane County and the Madison community. And make sure that those are properly resourced and that they also have the platforms and the access to the spaces where they can start to build that. So those are some things that folks can do tonight, and I'm definitely willing to talk more about all of those things. And I'm sure everybody up here on the panel is also willing to talk more about those things, how they're working on them and how you all can work on them, but I'll stop there for now and I'll pass it.
We also hear from Kaleem Kerr, Executive Director for the One City Early Learning Project, which argues for free preschool education for every child in Wisconsin. Kaleem opens with comments on Betsy DeVos, the newly confirmed secretary for the Department of Education under President Trump.
I just filmed a little video today, a little frustrated by people's fixation on Betsy DeVos. I know Betsy, I know her husband. I would not support her for Secretary of Education for probably many of the same reasons you all wouldn't. She's totally unprepared to serve in that office. But where I think being active and protesting is always important, what comes behind it? And what I keep seeing over the last 10 years in particular, probably longer than that, is as the protest isn't followed by any solutions. We wait for the next protest. And so that's why I get frustrated. So I made a little thing today and I just said, you know, what I'm going to be pushing for and what I hope all of you will support, I'm just hiring two consultants now to start talking to legislators and people in different offices in the state. What will it take for us to get to the point where preschool education can be free for every child in the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah.
If you want to create a game change for children, then make it free. K through 12 education is free. It's been free for many decades. But we now know with all the research that's come out about preschool education over the last 25, 30 years, that birth to five is the most important time in a child's life. And if that child is on the free market, their parents are on the free market, think about when people are most likely to have children. They're younger. They're not as well established in their careers, their relationships. They don't make as much money, but they're forced to pay college tuition for their child or children before they have any resources themselves. Relationships break up when children have younger kids, when parents have younger children. A lot of things happen. And so to stop that bleeding and get kids ready, let's invest in those children. Second thing is we have to reinvent public schools. There are Democrats and Republicans who will not support just giving more money to public education. And if you look at private entities that have done that, Mark Zuckerberg, my good friend Jim Shelton, that we created this organization that I led when I left Madison the first time, he now runs Mark's foundation. And he and I got into this back and forth as we're all into this digital education stuff. And he put $100 million into Newark, New Jersey, because Cory Booker was there, good friends, and Cory encouraged him to do it. Cory was also one of the founders of this organization I led, and they couldn't trace the money. A year later, a bunch of high-paid consultants got paid. They came in from everywhere, and they were all going to save the Newark school system. That's what happened to Mark's money. The Annenberg Foundation Challenge, which was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, D.C., where I spent a decade, got a ton of money. I think it was like $100 million, $150 million, something like that, out of that. They couldn't figure out what happened to the money. So just giving more money to these schools is not the solution. But I looked at it and I said, you know, if we gave money to, if we forced these Republicans, because they all understand investment funds and social enterprise and social capital and venture philanthropy and all these words that are being thrown around now, then let's create an investment fund for public education in the state of Wisconsin, where you have your floor form and formula funding for public education. And we got to do this, because what Betsy DeVos, I worry about, is they're going to kill Title I. They're going to rake that program of all of its resources and piddle and play around with it. That's what I'm worried about. But if we come with another alternative proposal, let's put resources into three things, programs. So let's make sure that the schools can offer real STEM education to children, that we can go to one of our high schools and their programs are decked out, that we actually have a real performing arts programs and things like that for our kids. The second thing is, let's create new schools completely. You know, West High School, East High School are old as dirt. My grandfather's uncle, Ted, was a first one among the first class of students at East High School in 1922. And he graduated in 1924. And the only thing different about that school is that they put older stuff around it that's quite not as old as the first piece, right? But when you look inside that school and you go inside the infrastructure, they're shooting things. I don't know much about construction, but they put all this foam-looking stuff everywhere to try to fill the cracks. How long are they going to do that? So let's recreate those schools. When you drive by them, they look as great as the building that Festival Foods is in on East Washington Avenue. We tell our children that they're worth the old building down the street, but the people that live in the high rise where they put Festival Foods and, oh, I hate to say it, Lindsay Lee is a good friend of mine, but Cargo Coffee, they're in these nice, beautiful buildings. Let's put money into that. And then the third thing is for just renovating schools in general all across the state, so not just new schools, but we've got to fix these busted schools. And a reason why I keep saying statewide is I don't think in this day and age, you guys, that we're going to be able to push an agenda that is needs-based. So it's just for poor people or it's just for black people. That's not, because in this country right now, just in the last 20 years, so many more people have fallen into poverty. So many more people have lost their middle-class standing, and they are struggling too. And the anxiety and the frustration that people are feeling is why Donald Trump is our president. And so if we don't create opportunities for people that cut across the board, then all of these things should, then we're going to end up in a situation where we continue to fight losing battles. So that's the thing. But then the third thing for us is economics. Like, I look at Madison, you guys, and this is something for the county board. I get frustrated because we grew up right next to the Lion Energy Center. And I've always dreamed of that place being like an entertainment playground, you know, where it's a destination place for the state. People around this state, our mayor, what he needs to understand, instead of taking 26 trips outside of Wisconsin, take 13 of those around the state and build our relationships there. But tell those people, make it inviting. This is their capital city. It's not just our isthmus. It is their capital city. Make it attractive. So I would take Capital North, Capital East, Capital West, Capital South, Capital Central. And I would create the history of this state and this city around those places, so they are destination places that people around this state will want to come to. So Oscar Mayer, everybody's worried about what's going to happen to Oscar Mayer. Madison's a socially driven community. I would be attracting businesses that are all about social enterprise, but driving that digitally, agriculturally, around the world. Those businesses are the ones that should be here, and we should build that world of Capital North around them. You see what I'm saying? So we got to think outside the box, because as we build, the last piece of this is we are not going to move large numbers of black and brown people out of poverty unless there are new jobs for them. Because when you don't have new jobs, now you're talking about trading jobs. And a lot of people, when they think about displacement, well, what's going to happen to me? You got to build the city. But right now what we're doing is we're allowing the city to build tons of housing because we've got an economic driver in Epic. Mm-hmm. What happens when Epic hits a wall? Mm-hmm. Where are all those, who's going to happen? What's going to happen to those housings? What's going to happen to the housing prices and property values in Madison and Dane County? Why aren't we building real businesses and getting people, like I would create Minority Business and Women Enterprise. Every project would be required to have real legitimate business for those individuals to help build the city, because that's when you build economic wealth, when people are building and starting and running successful businesses. But we're not doing that. We're just letting Findorff and everyone else who's already here run these programs, and they might hire two or three people, but they don't create and support new businesses. So I said this because what we got to do is we got to think outside the box. And there are other cities that are doing this. There are. D.C., where I came from, Mayor Williams was a genius. He helped do this. And before him, everybody hates Marion Barry. But Marion Barry created the wealthiest class of black people and Latinos in America. He forced the city, and that's why they went bankrupt. He said every kid's going to have a summer job. Every kid in the city of D.C. that was 16 years or older was able to have a summer job. He said no kid will be unemployed. He also ensured that businesses, Turner Construction, nope, you're going to give 30% of your business to some African-American other construction companies. Well, there's none here. Well, you're going to create them. And then all you see now, where I lived in Prince George's County, my kids were born here. They came back here. They were psyched out because they grew up in the wealthiest black county in America. It's the only place where the wealth of African Americans exceeds that of whites. We're 65% of the population. We own 56% of the businesses. They started Chick-fil-A here. My brother Bob owns the Chick-fil-A's in Prince George's County, all seven of them. And so they saw black wealth. They saw black fathers in parks playing with their kids. Why? Because they had the resource flexibility, the education, the wherewithal, the political power and astuteness to get out there and do that. So instead of just advocating for one city, where what we're doing is we're just getting kids ready for school. That's our main mission. So if you guys ever want to come see it, it's right over here at 2012 Park Street. I can tell you more about that. But I think we have a tremendous opportunity with all this energy and frustration that people have. Let's not give all that to Betsy DeVos. She's one rich lady who, honestly, she's going to be fine whatever we say about her. She'll still take her trips. She'll still wear nice clothes. She'll still be in that office at the Department of Education. But what about our children? Let's focus on creating an alternative proposal so she doesn't railroad our children in the future. Thank you.
You've been listening to Race to Equity, a Progress Report, with four panelists. Ken Taylor, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, Sharon Corrigan, Chair of the Dane County Board of Supervisors, Percy Brown, Director of Equity and Student Achievement for the Middleton School District, and Deshaun McKinney, President of the UW-Wisconsin Union and an activist in Black Lives Matter. The talk took place on February 8, 2017, at the South Madison Public Library and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County, and the Progressive. For this and other thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org.